ね。
Welcome back, everybody, to Season 2 of Wallace Hartley Presents the Podcast. I'm Glenn Lamont, along with Paul Chartier, and we are very excited to be back with Wallace Hartley, the podcast, after a very long break. So much happened last year. 2021 was, I think, you know, in 2020, when we first heard about COVID-19, I thought, this is pretty serious. And they were bringing in all kinds of health restrictions, and there was lockdown, and I was like, wow, yeah, this is heavy. Nothing compared to 2021. You know what I mean? And I'm a pessimist, so I'm like, yeah, it's just going to get worse. But when it actually did get worse, I was taken aback. I mean, we had the new variants, Delta and Omicron. Last year, what else happened? We had a big one, a huge one that was everywhere. I mean, it was international, was, of course, the discovery of the bodies at Kamloops, at the former residential school there. And then that's ongoing. As a matter of fact, today they just discovered more, I believe, in Prince George at another school. Some 50 plus bodies there, or maybe it was 90. That took up a lot of last year, which was a horrible thing to discover, but it was a good thing in that there was no more denying Canada's history with Indigenous people. It just wasn't. You couldn't do it anymore. For those that did, this was in your face. So I see that as a way to start moving forward. We have an incredibly overburdened healthcare system. It was overburdened, I think, before COVID happened. We have had anti-vaxxers, anti-maskers, crazy health recommendations changing daily. People are burning out from COVID, wildfires, heat wave, droughts, rain and toads. I don't know. Apocalyptic. I mean, what did you think, Paul?
It was quite the year. It's a good summary. There were multiple things, I think, on deck that really, I think, are putting people in a very different place, like in terms of how they're thinking and how they're living. And I remember very early days in COVID, where there were multiple conversations about, you know, the optimists were like 3 months, the pessimists were like 6 months, mm-hmm. the epidemiologists were like 2 to 4 years, everybody, right?
Yes.
Also, I agree with your sentiment on the residential schools. My conflict always is, given the colonial history in Canada, is I think we've actually already are starting to see some of it, is some of the damage control that's happening. I think the government's responding actually a little better than I actually expected. I thought it would be a lot more defensive. But you're right, this is overwhelming evidence that is really hard to sweep under the rug, this one. So.
Well, and you know, let's be honest, that's a show unto itself.
Absolutely.
The only thing I will say regarding the government's response was they were doing a great job of saying, hey, you churches, hand over the files. And when people were like, well, yeah, but you have files too, you know, yeah. that's still in court. So, I mean, they
Yeah.
really just like completely took
As much as I'm,
no responsibility.
Glenn, as much as I'm disappointed with the response, it seems, at least in some of these pieces, like with the evidence, for instance, being handed over, it looks like they're gaining some traction more than I thought. I mean, I understand the initial reaction to be like, nope, not happening. Because that's historically the default, right?
Yeah.
But I do think there's some very interesting things that went down with this movement, in a sense that I think in those last few years there's been a concerted effort, not with a lot of people, but you don't actually need a lot of people to actually start learning more of the history from an Indigenous point of view. So I think there's a little bit of traction in the population. Not a ton, but there's some there that wasn't there before. Maybe I'm being too optimistic, but I think sometimes when you harden a target, it's not like you don't stop bad things from happening, but you it's a little more noticeable, you know? So,
Yeah, and I mean, don't get me started. Like I said, it's a show unto itself, and that's a topic that, yeah.
So many things have compounded, right? So the pandemic, this horrific discovery, and the climate change issues, like that are actually impacting us, like in a dramatic way. It almost feels like here on the west coast of BC, like for years we've been like in the Goldilocks zone, because we would hear about all this stuff happening everywhere else, and now we're getting nailed. I mean, the heat dome was definitely an eye opener, and then the flooding. What it's all doing, though, is it's really, I think, really sharpening the focus. It's getting harder and harder to deny certain things that are self-evident if you're paying attention, I think, or if you're looking. You sometimes see what you're looking for, but I think it's really exposing, like inequality in many different levels in the culture and in the society, in terms of like what gets reported, what gets discussed, who's impacted, who can avoid this stuff, who can't,
Well,
like.
you're certainly seeing it in the form of the backlash. Like everything I see right now, even this truckers convoy across Canada, and all these, blue collar, white people talking about how, we're taking away their freedoms. And it's basically all of us on the left, right, that are behind it all, I'm sure.
Well, according to certain perspectives.
But you can
So
see it.
the latest on the truckers is they're getting financed by
Yes.
wealthy Western separatists from Alberta, so.
Yes. Well, that's not really a surprise.
Yeah.
Anyways, it's great. I'm just very excited that we're back. And this is season two, episode one, and I'm even more excited about our guest today. Very special guest joining the program. She was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York. Moved to Montreal in 1965, and eventually made her way out here to Vancouver, where she co-founded the Vancouver Catholic Worker with Sarah Bourknes. She holds a PhD. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. If I got any of this wrong, I may have a PhD in anthropology slash education and a master's of divinity
A
with
master's of
social
what?
justice work. Divinity?
Yeah.
Divinity? Did I get it wrong?
No,
Okay,
divinity.
good.
And of anthropology and the master of anthropology.
Okay, well, see, I was missing some. Her social justice work has taken her to Kenya, Mexico, Colombia, Grassy Narrows First Nation territory in northern Ontario. She's a former Franciscan sister and now one of only a handful of Roman Catholic women priests in Canada. And currently, the pastor of Our Lady of Guadalupe Tonantzin.
Tonantzin.
How do you pronounce it? Tonantzin community in the Vancouver's downtown east side. And finally, she is also the author of Transforming Addiction, The Role of Spirituality in Learning Recovery from Addiction. Please welcome to the podcast the Reverend Dr. Vicky Marie. How are you? I'm so excited that you're here.
Thank you. Shiva insisted on coming.
Well, good. Good. I was worried that she didn't get the email. It's great to have you. And one thing, you know, I got some of this stuff from your bio from the website for the Our Lady of Guadalupe community, but Grassy Narrows, but also our trip down to Vegas.
Oh, yeah.
And two actions there. And that was on Shoshone land when we went to protest the at the nuclear, no, it wasn't.
Nuclear test site? No.
Yeah, but they didn't call it a nuclear test site. The Nevada
Nevada test site, Strategic Command something or other.
Yeah, I still have this great photograph. I made my way up to the front of the line where that young man was speaking to that line of law enforcement and military. It was crazy. They had like the stereotypical sheriff in the middle with like the mirrored sunglasses, the cowboy hat, the big gut hanging over his belt buckle. And then on either side of him was two state troopers, Nevada state troopers. And then I think on flanking them on the ends was, I guess, Nevada National Guard or state armed forces. But it was just surreal. But I also have a great photograph, Vicky, of you drumming in the drum circle just before that action started. And what was the other one there? It was, oh, Creech Air Force Base.
Yeah.
That was the two actions.
And I remember at the Clown Hotel.
Don't even get me started. That was some creepy shit. Like who has Paul?
There, did you have go to a hotel with a convention?
No, that was the name of the hotel, and they had clowns all over. The guy was originally from Brooklyn as well, so Coney Island. He had all these like old clowns.
Oh.
And
stuff. Oh yeah, it wasn't creepy at all. I had a great sleep. Sarah.
It was the theme of the hotel. It was clowns.
Yeah. Sarah, who was, you know, that basically did the itinerary, the driving, booked that. And she, I know she may deny it, but she did it on purpose. Jesus. Anyways.
Maybe the hotel was a good price, Glenn. You never know.
I don't know. And you know what it was right next to? It was right beside an old miner's graveyard.
Oh.
Yeah.
That graveyard was on TV on one of those Discovery
mysteries.
Channel things or something.
Demonic possession. UFO.
But the reason we were there was for the 25th anniversary of the Nevada Catholic Worker.
Yeah, that's correct. And that was a great trip. So I'd like to say once again thank you for joining us today. And what, you know, I was talking to Paul about this before the show. A pretty amazing life that you've led and are leading. Tell us a little bit about growing up in Brooklyn and how you ended up in Canada, Montreal, and then all the way out here to the most expensive city in the galaxy.
Well, yeah, like I was born and raised in Brooklyn. I went Catholic school for 12 years. And I kind of lived in two worlds, like the world of school and then on the block, right? And it was during the time of Vietnam, so a lot of the guys I grew up with were going over and getting killed. It was the time of the civil rights movement, and I was too unwoke myself to actually participate in any of the goings on. But I felt I felt the weight of the racism, and both in society and in the church. And I was just, oh, and a lot of my friends have become heroin addicts. And so things were just kind of falling apart around me. And I had this friend whose boyfriend was going to McGill. And so a woman I met at work, and she was telling me about Montreal. So some of her friends from Montreal came down, and they said if I went to Montreal, I'd have a place to live. So I packed my boyfriend at the time, my cat at the time, and moved to Canada. They sent the boyfriend back because he didn't finish high school, and he had no employable skills that they were looking for in Quebec at the time. And
right,
I've been here in Canada ever since. And I moved to Montreal, to Vancouver the first time in 73, but I couldn't take the rain, so I moved back to Ottawa, because I had moved from Montreal to Ottawa. And then I couldn't take the snow, so I figured you don't have to shovel the rain. And so I came back to Vancouver. And I've been here now since 79, and this is home now.
Very much so.
Those were very interesting times to be in both places. So I hear you arrived in Montreal in 1965?
Yeah, so I was there for the War Measures Act.
Yeah. Yeah, and then in Vancouver in 73 was also kind of interesting.
Yeah, I didn't know too much what was happening, because I was working and I was doing a lot of work, overtime and stuff.
And so what was...
I was also still deep in my alcoholism at that time.
And of course, that's your book is essentially your thesis too, right?
Yeah, I sobered up in 1990.
Yes, you've been sober just a little bit longer than me. by about 25 years, I think. I'm coming up, let me see, April is going to be 16.
No, I'm just 16. I'm just twice as old as you in AA.
Oh, okay. There you go.
Almost like real life, eh?
Yes, almost like real life. So, and of course, you and I met in the downtown East Side. And there was so much, at that particular time. The first person who comes to mind, as far as activism goes, that I met down there was Sister Elizabeth.
Mm.
Who is no longer with us, and you weren't a part of her community, but you were a part of a community. But as far as the downtown East Side goes, it's the media still refers to it as the poorest postcode in Canada. It's shrinking at an alarming pace due to gentrification. So it's gone from probably when I came back to Canada in 2009, I'm going to say it was probably about, 15 or 20 square blocks at that time. And it's now like six. And during COVID, it was essentially, a no-go zone, really. They just abandoned people down there. And the opioid crisis, of course, is ongoing. And it's taken far more lives than COVID has from people in the downtown east side. And nothing in 10 years, nothing has improved. It's only gotten worse. And again, just throwing money at it. But could you...
I gotta say, though, that during COVID, the Carnegie Center and some of the other places down there have been really, really good at looking after people. Like they had, vaccine and testing available for people down there. So actually, the opioid crisis is actually doing more harm down there than COVID, because it didn't go as badly as was predicted for down there.
Well, yeah, and that was an odd thing, because in the beginning, and I don't know whether this was Vancouver Coastal Health not tracking in the downtown east side, or whether it was this weird, people who live down there just weren't getting COVID. And when you think about it, it's like, well, I know when the 6 years that I worked down there, I'm like, nothing can kill me now, because you're just exposed to everything on a daily basis. But when I talk about them being abandoned, they didn't have, nobody was providing for, in the beginning of that lockdown, for people in SROs. They were supposed to be getting hand sanitizer. They were supposed to be getting masks. They were, all this stuff. And none of it materialized.
Mm-hmm.
But either way, just give me your thoughts, having been involved in the downtown east side for as long as you have, with what do you think we could do to alleviate poverty and homelessness, which is huge in a nation as wealthy as Canada? Let's be honest, we have third world poverty right here in our city.
I think the problem, and this is going to sound corny, but I think it's spiritual, and not meaning spiritual in the sense of Christian spiritual, this and that. I mean, like, of the spirit. Like, society seems to have forgotten to work for the common good. Like what's happening with the weather, even things that Paul mentioned. Like, everybody's in it for the money, building in places that aren't made for it, letting people sleep in the streets because you want to let developers who can give you more tax money build their stuff. Like, the last thing I think I was active on in the downtown east side was actually protesting about the Balmoral Hotel, where people lived there for over a year with no running water, broken toilets, this and that. That to me is a crime. And the people who own that hotel, they don't pay any consequences.
The Sahotas.
Yeah. And
as a matter of fact, they got bought out.
Pardon?
They got bought out.
Yeah, after.
Yeah, but they profited.
But the people who suffered for a year, they didn't have any recompense or, you know. And so, you know, I'm going to go all over the place on this one. Like, they make laws, but only certain people have to obey them. You know what I mean? Like, even like with this Trans Mountain, over 200 and something people have been arrested, done jail time or community service, blah, blah, blah. The companies who are building that and the government is complicit in this, they're breaking their own laws, like with sound for marine life, with the amount of decibels you can have, with just so many things. And I had them written down, but I don't have it now. And they get fined like $1,000, $5,000, where they're putting 75-year-old ladies in jail.
Oh,
you know. And that's the way, but what I want to say is that's the way they're doing everything. They're letting, building these places for developers in the downtown east side that may be half full, and letting people sleep on the street. You know?
Yeah. Oh, I know. And Paul, you explained this to me quite some time ago, but you explained it very well, and maybe I'll get you to dive into it again, how Vancouver sold, you know, our city as the place to be starting way back in Expo 86.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm very familiar with that. I remember I was with a small group of people who were protesting Expo 86. It's funny because I run into people all the time now who were like, oh, yeah, I went there and did this and did that. And the reason why I think I didn't go to the final protest, which was going to be on opening day, is the federal and provincial and city government made it very clear that everyone who showed up that day was going to go to jail.
Mm.
No questions asked. You could not rain on the parade of Expo at all. As a matter of fact, my most cherished memory from that is a t-shirt that said "Trash the Expo Circus," and it had a picture of Bill Bennett and Jimmy Pattison with their heads popping up out of a garbage can looking like Oscar the Grouch. It was very nice art. I thought it was very, anyway, it's one of my favorite souvenirs from that time. So I think that laid the groundwork for what I've read about it, which makes the most sense to me, is it laid the groundwork for really large institutional money to come to Vancouver. Because up until that point, many people who've moved here recently didn't realize how sort of like provincial and small Vancouver was. You know, False Creek, like, when they built Granville Island, it was like considered this very fancy urbane thing to do because it got rid of all the log booms in False Creek. And, you know, it got rid of the last visual vestiges of industry in False Creek, except for the cement factory that was on Granville Island and still is. So there was this whole process politically where they consciously tried to attract international money to Vancouver. And that's when, like, the real estate started getting crazy. It took a while, but Vancouver suddenly became known as open for business in places that were booming. So one of the places that was booming when Expo hit and what it was all targeted for was that's when Japan was extremely wealthy and other parts of Southeast Asia were starting to boom, you know, like Taiwan and... Anyway, there was growing wealth. South Korea was building wealth, and they had all this money. And it's really interesting because Americans had a certain type of foreign policy where a lot of people don't know this and don't think of this as, from America, but America does this all the time. But all that money that was in Asia, they were not allowed as investors to buy American companies at the time. But they could buy real estate. So that's where the first big slush fund came. Americans also came to Vancouver and bought a lot of real estate. That's historical. The British always have. There's European investment in Vancouver. That's also quite historical. But this new boom of wealth that people were looking for things to go offshore, that's what attracted the first development and the first densification. The 80s was also a time when another thing that happened in Vancouver was the size of apartments started getting smaller, right? I think the linchpin in the whole historical process was when the last Liberal government came in 2001 and they radically changed the income assistance rules and how you could get on income assistance. So you remember you had to prove you were working for 2 years prior. So homelessness skyrocketed when that happened because people couldn't get on income assistance. And anytime you tried to like publicly make the linkage between the policy of income assistance and homelessness, like you were treated like you had mental illness. Like it was like, what are you talking about? Right. You know, so there's a few things I think that got put into place. More recently, we're also discovering that huge amounts of money, insane amounts of money from illegal activity has been laundered through the city as well. So that, I think, speaks a lot to, like, when you spoke, Vicky, about, like, it's actually spiritual, like, that's what it reminds me of. It's like this crisis of morality. It's like, well, as long as you make money, who gives a shit what happens?
Yeah.
Right? So the goal is to just, like, how can you increase profits? And when you're in that level of the 1%, you invest in real estate, all this homelessness happens. But from your perspective and your portfolio, you know, your property values, your assets, you know, the stuff Thomas Piketty talks about, I think that's his name, that French guy that just wrote this huge book about capital, right? Like your asset value just goes up and up and up. So as far as they're concerned, everything's working just fine, right? So anyway, I have lots of theories about why there's the level of homelessness there is. I think it really has to do with the movement of capital and how it's invested. I think that's a big piece of it. It has a lot to do with social policy as well. One of the things I've always asked, which Vicky, I think I'd love to hear your answer, is there's been housing crisis in many places all over the world. And in many of those places where there are housing crisis, one of the ways to address it has been with like a really aggressive and organized squatters movement. And that's never happened in Vancouver, which I find fascinating. I don't really have great explanations for it, but there were some movements sort of in the 90s and the early 2000s, but they weren't tolerated.
Yeah, and I think the police are too aggressive now. But a Medicine Hat, of all places, what they did is they built homes for the homeless, but they also had, like, services there for, like, mental health services and medical services and what do you call that, like, life skills services, all like in the complex. And I mean, and what they're spending on jailing people and doing all these other things besides building homes for people, I think they could do something like that, like they did in Medicine Hat, and it would, it's a holistic solution. If you have the services to help people as well as housing people, it's bound to succeed. And the city of Medicine Hat wound up saving money doing that.
Absolutely. And to you know, stay with your theme about how these issues are spiritual. It just seems that at what, you know, we followed in the footsteps of San Francisco in particular. You know, they always say that whatever happens in America, you know, is going to be up in Canada within 5 to 10 years. But, you know, so San Francisco saw that gentrification, you know, because it was attracting all this talent, tech talent, right? Software people and all that to Silicon Valley. And of course, they needed places to live, and they started gentrifying places like the Mission District, and real estate went through the roof. And, you know, the only people still working in the city were in the service industries and all the stuff that we saw here, right? Including like an incredible homeless population, massive homeless population. And, you know, Seattle, home of Amazon,
Microsoft.
Yeah, exactly.
Boeing.
We've seen it there and now here in Vancouver. But, you know, at what point do you say there's just, you know, there's not enough money. I just got to have more money, and I don't care if people are dying. I mean, is that what is actually happening, or are people not really thinking about it? Because I hear a lot of, like, I hear a lot of NIMBYism. Like, you specifically hear it every time, I hate to single out, like, a particular town, but I'm going to anyways. Every time you hear even an inkling about, you know, some kind of social housing or rehab center, Maple Ridge just flips out. They're just like, no, like, we don't want to help people. Just leave us alone. God, we don't want those people here. And of course, you know, Maple Ridge and other places like it, the homeless population has been moving east. It's been moving out to the suburbs. It's all the way out to Chilliwack. And how can you, forget as a developer, how can you as a human being ignore that? Like, at what point, you know, do you not decide that, okay, it's too much? I mean, do you see that as part of the crisis?
I don't know, because, you know, a lot of people, like, unless you, like, take the bus or walk around, you don't see these things, right? And it's only newsworthy when there's a crisis of something going wrong, like, not so much of the homelessness, but of the homeless person doing something bad, you know.
Committing crimes.
And, which reminds me, you mentioned about the Indian residential schools. The news talked about Kamloops, but there's been several more discoveries since then, and the news hasn't updated the numbers, you know, between Kamloops and today. So there's already, about 3,000 or 5,000 that they found.
Yeah, and the media doesn't update it because it's not news anymore. You know what
okay,
I mean?
But that gets to my point. How can people be informed to revise their what they think they know and change their opinions and be compassionate and understand history, unless they're told? I mean, like, quite a few of the churches of all denominations and temples and whatever have groups that are trying to teach people about the real history and stuff. But when you're talking about just the average person of European descent, unless they hear something on the news, it's not going to turn their crank to find out more.
Well, without going into this too much, because as Paul will tell you, I can talk about it for a long time.
Yeah, but that's the same thing like with all these issues. Like,
yeah,
they have to be brought to the people's attention, right?
But here's the thing. The average white person in Canada, you know, they're big on, tell me what I can do to make myself feel better about this. They don't want to do any hard work. They don't want to read the Truth and Reconciliation Commission recommendations. They don't even want to read, you know, a book from an Indigenous author. They just want, tell me what I can do. Give me some performative allyship thing I can do. Like, what do I got to do? I got to hang like a dream catcher from my rearview mirror? Just give me something. Fill me in. They don't want to do any work. And that is a big part of the problem, right? And I've had
so
these...
I wanted to ask both of you. So I've been at this change game for quite a while, and one of the things that I think maybe I'm giving up. This is why I'm asking this question, is I agree with what you're saying, Glenn, and I agree, Vicky, that informing people is really important. What I've come to believe is that you actually don't need a lot of people informed and active. You can inform a lot of people and very few of them will act on it. But if you can get to a certain critical mass of people who are willing to act on it, you don't actually need a lot to make change. But you need a critical mass. You need a certain number of people. And my hope is that there's enough people willing to look at this stuff and do a bit of the work that it may shift. And I'm not sure if I'm too optimistic or if I'm being blinded by something, if I'm, you know, a little too Pollyanna on this, but I've just seen more curiosity. These are people who like would be willing to learn this stuff a little bit more than others to begin with. But I think some of the information, and if you actually read it like an Indigenous author, it would motivate you to actually get involved and make sure shit like this doesn't ever happen again. Like, I think, like, and if there's just enough that do that, because the other thing I've learned, which I've come to accept, is just being informed does not create change of behavior. We've seen that with climate change. You can tell people all the facts you want, and that doesn't do much. It impacts some people. My hope, again, is like, do we get enough people, enough of a small enough group to shift things?
I kind of agree with you, but I still think you need other people who are at least going to sympathize with you, right? Because, like, for instance, on the news, they talk about protesters and climate activists, they never talk about, they don't say water defenders or land defenders, you know? Like, people are trying to keep the water clean for everybody. Like, you know, it's the news is not, how would you call it, when you're supposed to, objective. The language used in the news forms opinions. And I think that they gotta stop that. They gotta be objective, whether they feel objective or not. Because I agree with you that you need that amount of people, but then you need a little more than that to support those people.
Yeah, that's true. You need some supporters that maybe won't be activists, but they'll be sympathetic. They'll support you in other ways. They'll speak up at public meetings. They'll, you know, donate money. They'll organize book reading clubs, whatever, right? Like they'll do kind of soft skill stuff that you need to build enough momentum for the activists to get supported, right? So.
But I mean, I agree, with what Vicky said regarding the media. I mean, the media is completely ignoring the whole We Stand With Wet'suwet'en movement and that particular pipeline battle, right? And they have the I don't know if you've seen the tiny house warriors, and they just move around in this these mobile houses, right, on trailers and stuff. But now one of the or two or one or two were just acquitted because they were in court for I'm not sure arrest, resisting arrest or something like that. But one of them, she had her wrist broken by these arresting officers. None of this
They're
occurred
not
really.
arresting officers, they're militarized police.
Yeah, they are. And that's the point I was getting to is that how can you ignore that the federal police force is essentially now a private security company, akin to Blackwater, working on behalf of the fossil fuel industry, which is essentially what they're doing. But, the media is not going to say that.
Well,
The media
I just want to
wants
make a
people to
quick
be
comment.
horrified by other things, but not by
Yes.
that.
I mean, I agree with everything. There's an American writer I really like because of his analysis of media. His name's Matt Taibbi, and he reminds people on a regular basis that news is a product that you're consuming. It's a product, it's something for sale. So it's not neutral, it's not a public service. That's not what it's there for. Even though we have like the CBC, which is, it's still biased. And the other comment I wanted to make was like land defenders, water defenders, like anybody who's not like, my apologies to those who are fans of like Greta, that young Swedish woman. I mean, she'll go to Davos and she'll get on the magazine covers and all that kind of stuff because she's not a threat,
No.
right? Whereas Canada foundationally was founded on resource extraction. Therefore, the entire wealth of the country is from resources of the land. So anyone who defends their land from that process is criminalized, and the big guns come out. And we see that all the time, right? The media, who are being paid for by a lot of resource extraction companies, and the Canadian government, which is getting a lot of tax dollars, not as much as they should, out of resource extraction companies that fund the CBC, are not going to touch this stuff with a 10-foot pole. They will not use language like land defenders or water defenders. They will not use anything that reminds people that foundationally everything we exist on has to do with the resource extraction.
Absolutely. Now I'm gonna come back to that when we wrap up. But Vicky, let's talk about what I consider to be a fascinating aspect of who you are, and something that, I guess if you're an old school lefty like me and Paul, that's how, by the way, Paul, one of our colleagues described just the other day said, "Well, I don't have to explain it to you, Glenn. You get it." And I think the only other old school lefty I know is Paul. I'm like, should I be offended by this? But we would be aware of this, but many people aren't, of who Dorothy Day is or was, and the Catholic worker movement.
Okay. Dorothy Day was also from Brooklyn.
Really?
A
Didn't know that.
journalist and what do you call it? The women voters, what do you call it?
Suffragette.
Suffragette. And And pretty much part of the Roaring Twenties thing, like, she hung out with, like, Eugene O'Neill and some of those I guess old school lefties of the time.
Exactly.
And she was influenced by the communist philosophy. But she got pregnant, and her family had a place on Staten Island, and she started going to church over there in Staten Island, and she met this nun who really influenced her, and so she kind of got influenced by faith, but she figured the churches weren't doing anything to help, and it was, I think, the start of the Depression. And then she met Peter Morin, and he told her about Catholic social teaching, which he said was the best kept secret in the church. And and his philosophy was that people should have houses of hospitality, group discussions for the clarity of thought, and farm communes where professors would farm and workers would teach. So kind of turning society upside down. And even before she had her own apartment, she started giving a place to stay to people. She was still, I think, in her sister-in-law's house, apartment, and this woman came to the door. Oh, and they started a newspaper saying those principles. And somebody read in the newspaper that they were talking about houses of hospitality. So this woman came to the apartment, and Dorothy didn't have her own place, but she gave her daughter's bedroom to sleep in. Finally, they got an apartment, and they started the Catholic Worker Movement, where they produced a newspaper. They gave a place to stay to the homeless in a home setting, not in a kind of institutional setting. Mm-hmm. And that was in the 30s. And the movement caught on, and there's now houses of hospitality all around the world. And no two houses of hospitality are alike, because they try to fit them with the needs of where they're situated. Like for us here, well, in Seattle there was one that they didn't provide hospitality in their home, but they ran a soup kitchen. And then in Olympia, they had a house for battered women, or women in, you know, who needed refuge. But the women lived in one house and the Catholic workers lived in another. And then in another, they lived together, and they were really lucky in Olympia, because this woman gave them property so they could expand. So they had a few houses on the block. And when we started ours, we decided not to have a specialty, because the needs were kind of, homeless needs were too great. We started in 1998. And The only thing was, because of where we are, we couldn't take anybody in active addiction or way too mentally ill, because we don't have the skills to deal with that. And we're too close to temptation for somebody who's active in their addiction. But even up to this fall, we took somebody in who, because of the floods in Abbotsford.
Right. And I mean, in the time that I've known you guys, you and Sarah, you've always had somebody in the house, sometimes more. And, you know, it really is one of, I would have to say, it's one of Vancouver's best kept secrets. The Vancouver Catholic Work Order, nestled in the downtown east side, and I guess officially Strathcona. But, you know, there was a ton of stuff I wanted to squeeze in. it's become very apparent we're going to have you back on the program, because we just don't have enough time. I wanted to talk more about your work you're doing with your community now. I wanted to talk about, your whole thing regarding spirituality, and could it be one of part of at least the solution to many of these problems? I'm going to leave links for Vicky's community. I'm going to leave a link for the Vancouver Catholic Worker and some info on Dorothy Day for those of you who would like to know a little bit more about that. But I can't thank you enough for being here. You are an amazing individual who has been, I don't know where to start there, but suffice to say, you've been so much help to me personally, and many of those long, long talks, I'm going to apologize now for bending your ear all those evenings.
It's good. It's better than me talking to me.
But just so you know, I think it actually did some good. Paul, thank you so much for being along for the ride. And Wallace Hartley Presents the podcast. If you want to catch us, we're available on Podbean. We are available on Spotify and Google Play. And you can also, if it's not enough to hear our incredibly, velvety tones, you can also look at our ugly mugs on YouTube on Wallace Hartley Presents the podcast YouTube channel. Thanks for joining us, Vicky.
Thank you for having me.
It was really nice.
And thank you.
I hope we can do it again.
For those who tuned in, and once again, just thrilled to be back with season two of Wallace Hartley Presents a podcast. Thank you all for joining us. Take it easy, be good to one another, and stay safe.